After last month's physiology extravaganza, we decided to actually continue with the physiology, but hopefully leave out all the bickering that we had last time. Who knew we would foreshadow the presidential debates, am I right? In all seriousness, last month described some cutting-edge point-of-care ultrasound that will put you way ahead of your peers and me. We were able to get the peer review from one of our alumni, Dr. Dan Falvey, who also loves ultrasound, and had some good private practice perspective if you want to listen to it. It's added on to last month's podcast if you want to re-download it and listen. The audio is a little bit rough, but the content is fantastic. But this month, the physiology has shifted to the airway. This is based on an article out of our own ED entitled The Physiologic Difficult Airway. The premise is that videoscope, supraglottic airways, and the like have led to far less cutting on the neck and floundering around in the epiglottis in order to get these patients intubated. So management of the anatomic difficult airway, not as big of a deal as it once was. The bigger problem now is optimizing these patients so they don't arrest while you're trying to get the tube in. And to avoid a debate, I have matched wits with someone far superior to me in every way so that there's really no argument. Airway man himself, Dr. John Sackles. So we're starting out in October's episode with airway man himself, Dr. John Sackles. Thank you very much. I've been wanting to talk to you about airway stuff for a long time, but I didn't feel I knew enough about airways to actually ask an intelligent question. So thanks for coming.
I'm happy to be here.
So what we're going to talk about is the physiologically difficult airway. And the perspective from this comes from a paper that you co-wrote with Jared Mosier and Cameron Hypes and Raj Joshi and Garrett Pacheco and some of the faculty that we have here, basically describing that the anatomic airway, the difficult anatomic airway, is something that we've started to overcome with fairly good frequency and consistency, but now we need to focus on optimizing the patient's physiology before we take away their airway. Could you give us a little bit of a update of just, you know, from the beginning of time until where we're at now with airways?
Right. So to give you some historical background, when I was training, the only device we had for airway management was a direct laryngoscope. And as you know, you have to get a direct line of sight to the airway with that device. So we focused heavily on anatomic predictors of difficulty. That was a big concern of ours. Now with the newer technology with flexible fiber optic scopes and rigid video laryngoscopes, the anatomically difficult airway is less of a concern than it has been previously. And now I think difficult physiology is becoming more of a concern in the clinical management of patients in the emergency department and the ICU.
I know that arguments you've heard in the past is that, well, we can't all have these great devices that you have there in Tucson, which is a shout out to any medical students listening. You should come to Tucson and play with our cool airway toys. But how much have you seen that change over the years when you started having this debate with people about whether or not VL or DL is superior?
Right. Well, that's kind of a complicated issue. I think when I first started using VL 15 years ago, it was controversial what approach should be used. And I think now in 2016, it's the debate about VL versus DL is not that important. But I think it's important that if you are in an emergency department, you have a video laryngoscope available to manage difficult airways. So I'm not saying you have to use it for every airway, but it's a standard of care to have access to video laryngoscope so you can manage your difficult airways.
And are you seeing that a lot more places, even rural places, are starting to have some kind of video device?
Well, you know, I teach the airway course all over the country, and every time we teach the course, we have about 100 participants, and these are people that are working in very rural areas, a lot of them in critical access areas, and they all have access to a video laryngoscope. In fact, that's why they take the courses, because they're working in these small departments by themselves without any backup, and they've got a video laryngoscope, and they want to know how to use it for their difficult airway cases. So, yeah, it's I haven't really encountered anyone that doesn't have access to a video laryngoscope.
I'd like to break in here and make a quick comment about the rural sites. I was teaching the pediatric procedures lab at ASEP, and I met ED docs from across the globe who work in low-resource, critical-access hospitals that, frankly, give me nightmares. I go to sleep most nights very thankful that I have an army of consultants to argue with every shift. These docs have to be ready for everything all by themselves. And as one of the docs put it, most nights it's me, a nurse, and a clerk, and that's it. So if you have to recruit one of your other patients to help you bag, you've really, really got to have your stuff down. If you're listening to this and you take calls from these remote areas, think twice before you ask them why they're transferring. If you're listening to this and you take calls from these remote areas, think twice before asking them, why are you transferring this patient, or why haven't you done the IVV on ultrasound yet? And for those of you who work these sites, Kevin Durant said it best, you the real MVP. So where we're at now with the physiologic difficult airway, we have a few things that you guys laid out in the paper as far as four big factors that should make you concerned that this patient will not do well or may not even survive your intubation attempt, no matter how good you are at putting the tube through the cords. So the four things were hypoxemia, hypotension, metabolic acidosis, and right ventricular failure, which all of those seem pretty good, and all of these seem like things that if you're confident in your airway skills, we're going away a little bit from rapid sequence induction and doing more of a, let's get the patient as optimized as possible so that I know that I can get my tube in the right place and that the patient's going to survive that brief period of apnea or that brief period while I'm altering their physiology with medications.
Yes, and just to add to that, really, we talked about how anatomic difficulties were our primary concern historically, like when I was training when I was a resident. But also you have to recall that back then, 20 years ago, ABCs were airway was first. So we always wanted to secure the airway as the initial mode of resuscitation. And now I think over time we've realized that airways take on a secondary role and that it's more important really to optimize the physiology before you instrument them and institute positive pressure ventilation. So that's been another change over the last 20 years.
It's still hard for me to give up ABC, though. It's so difficult. I love airway so much. So, coming to hypoxemia, which is probably the easiest one, I mean, having a patient come in and you see that they're hypoxic, the gut reflex is let's hurry up and help them in whatever way possible. And intubation is not a rapid sequence induction, and intubation is not really the best way to help these patients right off the bat. We need to optimize their oxygen reserves before we can actually go in and start trying to take the airway. So for starters, pre-oxygenation, I know that we've had a few methods that we've gone through here at the University of Arizona with different ways to pre-oxygenate. I've seen non-rebreather with a nasal cannula on as well, and now we even have more than that. We have the super-duper high-flow 70 liters per minute nasal cannula. When you're pre-oxygenating a patient that comes in already hypoxic from, say, COPD, what's kind of your first go-to when you're approaching this patient to get them well oxygenated?
Well, you have to realize that when you're doing rapid sequence intubation, there's a relatively small volume of oxygen available in the lungs for that patient during that period of apnea that's associated with paralysis. So it's really important that before you even attempt intubation is that you maximize the volume of oxygen in the lungs. And typically the method we use to do that is pre-oxygenation with a non-rebreather. Unfortunately, some recent literature suggested that our current methods of pre-oxygenation are not very optimal. Our pre-oxygenation strategies are based on what's done in the operating room, and as you know, in the operating room, they use an anesthetic circuit with a very nice mask that has a good seal. In the emergency department, we use a non-rebreather mask that have the rigid masks that have a huge air leak around them. So when we pre-oxygenate in the ED with 15 liters on a non-rebreather, we're actually getting very poor pre-oxygenation benefits from that.
And we're actually, and when we have a non-rebreather on, we've usually got the mask flaps. We've got one of them off so that we don't accidentally suffocate the patient on the non-rebreather. It's supposed to fit very tightly with those two one-way valves, but we usually have one of those popped off. So you're not even getting as much as you think you're getting through a non-rebreather.
Right. And if you look at the recent literature that they've done on healthy volunteers, if you use a standard non-rebreathing mask in the ED with all the leaks that we're describing, you actually only get an end-tidal O2 of about 50% after 3 minutes at 15 liters. And as you know, when you pre-oxygenate, your goal is to get your end-tidal O2 as high as possible in the 80 to 90% range. So the efficacy of what we're using right now is not that great.
So I've got a patient that's been on their non-rebreather. They've been on for maybe 3 minutes or so while I'm getting all of my airway equipment together. I'm getting my tube size selected. I'm getting my post-intubation sedation together. And they're still only at about 94%. Previously, I would say, well, I guess that's as good as we're going to do. Let's go ahead and induce and hope for the best. But now we're moving more to doing more of a delayed sequence intubation where we're putting these patients on non-invasive positive pressure ventilation, whether it's BiPAP, CPAP, whatever you have available, full face mask, or even just prongs that I've done with little kids, and tried to get them oxygenated through that method. And I've only done it a handful of times, but I've had a whole lot more success in these patients that are really difficult to look at because they look like they're about to crap out on you at any moment, but you see their sats slowly get up. It's a whole lot easier than bagging them, too.
Right, so that's a whole other issue. So you're talking about the patients with physiologic shunt that are unresponsive to increases in FiO2 with your non-rebreather. Those patients require positive pressure ventilation with PEEP in order to get their maximum concentration of oxygen in their lungs. And you'll see if you have a patient on a non-rebreather with sats of 94%, and then you put them on BiPAP for a few minutes, in most of those patients, you can get their sats up to, you know, almost close to 100%.
So as far as hypoxic patients go, when they come in and they're hypoxic, is there anybody that you look at and say, we just need to put a tube in right now? Or are you trying to optimize pretty much every patient, even if they look like they've got the O sign and they're about to fall over in bed?
Right. The important thing you have to remember is when we intubate someone, really, they don't need an endotracheal tube as much as they need oxygen. So if you're going to put an endotracheal tube in, it's important to maintain their oxygenation during that time period. And if you start out intubating a hypoxemic patient, their risk of developing severe hypoxemia and the consequences of that as dysrhythmias, hypoxic brain injury, and even cardiac arrest are very high. So I think it behooves us to maximize their oxygenation before we even start to instrument their airway.
And there was a good paper that I remember you've shown about that that shows where the curves are at depending on what your oxygen level is before intubation, how much reserves you have. You had that. It was with children, and then it was with people with severe hypoxemia before intubation, and then a healthy volunteer. And they fall off that cliff very, very quickly if you take away their reserve.
Right. That's the classic paper by Benyumov that I showed you, which showed the oxygen desaturation for varying states of illness and ages, and in the pediatric population and the critically ill, they desaturate much more rapidly.
Your progression is you see a patient that comes in on oxygen by EMS, they're hypoxic, they're showing signs of respiratory failure clinically because we're still not getting blood gases on these patients or waiting for a chest x-ray to determine whether or not they need to be intubated. This is still a clinical decision. But during that time, you're first putting them on a non-rebreather, cranking it up as high as you can. And if you're not achieving adequate results within 3 minutes, 5 minutes or so, are you switching to non-invasive positive pressure at that point?
Right. I think that's a reasonable approach. Also, there's some recent literature that came out that suggests that the reason we're not getting optimal pre-oxygenation with a non-rebreather is because the flow rate we're using at 15 liters is actually too low, and they're entraining too much room air. And it turns out that if you crank up the wall oxygen to as high as it goes, which turns out it's about 50 to 70 liters, that you could greatly increase their end-tidal O2 from about 50% up to about 80%. So that would be my first approach, is to maximize the flow rate to their non-rebreather mask. The other thing I like to do is put a nasal cannula under the non-rebreather and give them 15 liters like that. So if you're giving that amount of oxygen to them, in most patients, that amount will get their saturations up to a reasonable level.
So turn the non-rebreather knob until it falls off, and then just give them as much oxygen as possible. And then with the nasal cannula that you have on underneath, you leave that on while you're intubate in order to provide apneic oxygenation, which has been shown to have some really dramatic effects in preventing hypoxemia during intubation.
Right. And actually, we did a study from here a couple of years ago where we looked at the impact of apneic oxygenation on first-pass success without hypoxemia, and we found that that 15 liters of nasal cannula actually helped improve first-pass success without the occurrence of hypoxemia. And in retrospect now, thinking about it, it may not just be the benefit of apneic oxygenation. It may be the benefit of having that additional 15 liters by nasal cannula during the pre-oxygenation phase, because in effect, we were giving them 15 liters by face mask plus 15 liters by nasal cannula, so they were getting 30 liters pre-oxygenation. So the benefit that we describe from apneic oxygenation might be partly due to benefit from improved pre-oxygenation.
Now, is there anyone, regardless of their oxygen status before you intubate them, is there anyone that you don't provide apneic oxygenation to anymore with intubation?
That's a good question, because the literature on apneic oxygenation is somewhat controversial. In fact, there was a randomized trial out of Vanderbilt that showed in the critically ill, apneic oxygenation did not reduce the incidence of oxygen desaturation. And those results are obviously different than what we found here. And I think the big difference is their patient population were ICU patients that had a high incidence of respiratory disease, pneumonia, ARDS. A lot of them were on BiPAP and non-invasive ventilation. And I guess the way I look at the conflicting results is that apneic oxygenation probably is going to be effective if you're intubating someone with for airway protection that has no airspace disease. But I think it's probably going to be of very little utility or maybe no utility in patients with underlying lung disease, particularly patients that have physiologic shunt due to pneumonia or ARDS.
But it sure makes me feel a little bit better to see that on their face while I'm going in to try to intubate. So, or better yet, while I'm watching somebody else intubate, which I don't know how you've done this all these years, being an airway guru and watching people intubate like me. It's got to be like watching someone else play a life-threatening video game.
Yeah, you get used to it over time. You become more and more relaxed over it. And if I could just say a few words about delayed sequence intubation that you mentioned. Historically, we've performed the rapid sequence intubation, and the idea was that with rapid sequence intubation, you'd optimize the patient before intubation, primarily get them well oxygenated before the procedure. There's some patients in the emergency department that are too combative and too hypoxic to really optimize for rapid sequence intubation. So you're stuck either just saying, well, I'm just going to go for it and push the drugs, or you can say, I can give them medication to try to optimize or oxygenation before intubation, and that's what delayed sequence intubation is. There's a lot of confusion about how to use it, but the way I see it is I use delayed sequence intubation in a patient that's too hypoxemic to intubate and I'm unable to optimize them without giving them some medication to tolerate either the non-rebreather mask or the BiPAP mask. The important thing to remember is that when you start doing a delayed sequence intubation, as soon as you administer whatever drug you're going to use, and what I recommend is ketamine, you should be ready to intubate them at that moment. As soon as you push that ketamine, you may have apnea, you may be forced to intubate. Hopefully, if you give it slowly in a small enough dose, it'll allow you to oxygenate the patient for a few minutes and get their sats up before intubation. But whenever you do a DSI, you have to be prepared from that moment to perform the intubation. You should never be walking away from the bed, pushing the drug, and come back to check on them later.
So we've got our patient that's hypoxic, but we fixed that. They come in, they're still huffing and puffing. We're still pretty sure they need to be intubated. Let's say it's a CHF exacerbation, but we look up and see that this patient's now hypotensive. Their blood pressure is 60 over 40. Once we take away their sympathetic drive with whatever we use as an induction agent, their blood pressure is probably going to go even lower. And once we fill their lungs with more pressure, we're going to drop their preload and drop their blood pressure even further. So how do we try to optimize these patients that need to be intubated for a variety of reasons but are also hypotensive?
Right. That's an important consideration, because most patients that we intubate will have some degree of hypotension associated with it for a couple of reasons. One is that the induction agents we use cause some degree of hypotension, and the transition to positive pressure ventilation decreases venous return to the heart, and in these volume-depleted patients actually can worsen their hypotension as well. So it's really important that you have your patient optimized from a hemodynamic standpoint and use fluids or pressors, if they're indicated, to maximize your blood pressure before you start intubation. If you have a shock index greater than 0.8 or 0.9, and you intubate that patient, you have a seriously high risk of having post-intubation hypotension and post-intubation cardiac arrest.
And I've heard the residents say that they can't intubate with you unless they know what the shock index of the patient is, which I think is pretty good.
Right. I think it's important to realize that when you're managing someone's airway, investing about 5 or 10 minutes in optimizing them, getting their sats at an adequate level, pre-oxygenating them, getting their blood pressure improved, starting an infusion of norepinephrine, really pays its dividends later on once you intubate them. You could avoid a lot of complications such as severe oxygen desaturation and hypotension associated with the intubation. So it's a few minutes well spent.
So you recognize this patient has signs of significant shock. So most any type of shock is initially responsive to volume. So we give the patient some volume and then we try to get them optimized. You're trying to get their shock index to below 0.8. So you, doing that, you're using either fluids or you're using vasopressors. Are you starting these patients on just peripheral infusions or are you doing push doses of pressors to try to get them up there? What's your approach to these patients?
My approach usually is to start off with fluid resuscitation because most patients that are hypotensive in the ED are probably going to be volume down. They're in hemorrhagic shock or septic shock and need volumes. The one exception is a patient in pulmonary edema with heart failure. But in general, most patients will respond to a little bit of volume. And then patients that don't respond, I add an infusion of norepinephrine and get that going before I even start the intubation.
And the results have to be striking with this. I mean, this is a real far cry from what we used to do, which was rapid sequence and just trying to go in and dealing with the fallout whenever it happened. How do you kind of control the rest of the room who knows this patient needs their airway taken care of, but we're trying to optimize all of these other things? Have you noticed a change with nursing staff or with our pharmacists or even some of the other colleagues when we're trying to optimize all of this instead of going right in for the throat?
Right. I think people are starting to appreciate this more, and that article we wrote on the physiologic difficult airway has sort of increased interest and awareness of this issue. And I think most people, the nurses, the residents, the respiratory therapists, appreciate that it's important to resuscitate your patient before you intubate them. And I think they're all on board with that.
So going for these induction agents, for me, being a pediatrician, I tend to love ketamine as an induction agent. I put ketamine in my cereal. I think that it's good for pretty much any problem the emergency department has.
Right. Ketamine is actually an interesting drug in that it actually has direct myocardial depressant activity. We don't typically see that because it also is an indirect catecholamine releaser. So when most patients you give ketamine to, you actually see an increase in their heart rate and blood pressure. There are some patients that are so catecholamine deprived that when you give ketamine, you don't have any benefit of catecholamine release, and all you see is the direct myocardial depression. And some patients that get ketamine that are depleted like that can actually become more hypotensive and have cardiac arrest. So that's been well documented. Etomidate's a very neutral agent, so I tend to use it in full dose in most patients. If they have a blood pressure less than 90, I might go down to half dose etomidate or something like that.
So having these patients, some of the more difficult patients that I've had to approach that you look at and say, not only are you going to be anatomically a problem, but you're in septic shock. And is that an old trach hole I see there? Those kinds of patients that I've approached, I've tried to give them full dose ketamine and I've had them go apneic on me, which we don't think of ketamine as something that usually will cause apnea. We use it for awake intubations. How could this possibly happen? But pretty much any of these medications, if you push enough of it fast enough, you're going to get apnea and you're going to get hypotension.
Yes, that's a very good point. I think of all the induction agents we have, ketamine is probably the safest in terms of preserving respiratory drive and airway protection. However, if you push ketamine fast, you can get apnea with it. Also, if you use ketamine with other drugs, they're getting a little fentanyl with it or some midazolam, or they overdosed on benzo or something like that, giving ketamine can also cause apnea. So it's a fairly safe drug, but it's not entirely risk-free.
So if you've got a patient who, say, is a status asthmaticus that you're intubating, and their lungs are already completely expanded, and they're dry from insensible losses, and maybe you didn't expect hypotension to be a problem, but now that you've placed that tube and you've squished the heart into the last corner of the chest that it can, what do you do to address those patients' hypotension when they have it immediately after intubation?
I think those patients probably are suffering from hypotension due to volume depletion. If they've been tachypneic now for hours or days, their insensible losses are very high. So those patients are almost always dry. So I think an aggressive fluid bolus under pressure would be the appropriate thing. And if you're not getting the response you want, it wouldn't be unusual to use a vasopressor such as epinephrine or norepinephrine.
And the push-dose phenylephrine, which was all the rage several years ago, that Jared's not here so I can make fun of him. He said everybody should be using this and then came back and said, no one should be using this. This is kind of like baking, of where you figure out what's going on with your patient individually and use the best tools at your disposal. Is that fair?
Right. I guess my feelings about phenylephrine is it's a direct alpha agonist, so you're only getting vasoconstriction. So in most patients that are critically ill, they probably would benefit from a different vasopressor, such as norepinephrine. I think phenylephrine is reasonable to use if their hypotension is due to the induction agent and you just have venodilation that you're trying to counteract. But in general, I think norepinephrine is probably going to be the better vasopressor to use in the critically ill.
And again, being a pediatrician, I have a love affair with epinephrine. You can give it sub-Q, you can give it IM, you can give it inhaled, you can give it IV. I really have not found a bad use for epinephrine either. So it's got some ionotropy, it's got some squeeze, it's got what ails you if you've got a sick patient. So for me, what I've kind of seen in these patients is a little very, very small pushes of epinephrine as we're starting an epinephrine drip would be another, would be the one that I would prefer to go to.
Right. I think epinephrine is a great drug in the critically ill, because you're getting your vasoconstriction, but you're also increasing your cardiac output with it. So I think it's a great choice, and I never go to work without it.
So starting over again, we've got our patient's hypoxia, which we've optimized through starting them on nasal cannula, non-rebreather, and then going to non-invasive positive pressure ventilation if need to. And we're apneically oxygenating these patients as well. We address their hypotension. If their blood pressure is low, we're starting with fluids, and we're not pushing that induction agent until they either declare themselves that they've gone completely apneic or we've gotten their blood pressure to something reasonable. And that's using either fluids or vasopressors, whichever is indicated by the situation. And if the patient manages to have further hypotension, we can start some fluids and then maybe a few pushes of something a little bit stronger like epinephrine or cranking up the norepinephrine a little bit higher. Moving from that one, metabolic acidosis. This is the point you made in this paper, which I loved, which is try not to intubate these patients. So the first thing about intubating a patient with a severe metabolic acidosis is don't intubate them.
Yes. In general, these patients that have DK, that have profound acidosis, usually don't require intubation, in my opinion. They need a correction of their metabolic derangements. Intubation is not likely to be very helpful and actually may be very dangerous in them. Most of them have a mental status that's reasonable and they're protecting their own airway. So your benefit from trying to perform invasive mechanical ventilation is probably pretty low.
These, I've heard you say, and I can cut this out if you don't want me to say it, take no pride in intubating a 100-year-old person. So I would say similarly, take no pride in intubating somebody who is doing much better on their own than before you put the tube in. So having had a few of these patients, really, really sick DKA patients that are breathing through pursed lips, they're tripodding, they're starting to get a little bit drowsy, but they're taking amazing volumes and their minute ventilation is off the charts, they're doing a much better job than I could do with a coffee stir stick in their throat and a breathing machine.
Right. And really, the real risk with trying to manage the airway in these patients and performing tracheal intubation is that their minute ventilation is so high because they're trying to correct for their metabolic acidosis. They may be having a minute ventilation of 30 or 40 liters per minute, which is huge. And if you're going to try to RSI a patient like that, you're going to push your paralytic agent. And now for a minute, they've gone from a minute ventilation of 30 down to zero. And what's going to happen during that time is the pH, which they were barely compensating for, is now going to become even lower. And they're going to have profound acidosis, which might precipitate dysrhythmias and might precipitate a cardiac arrest. So the safest thing to do is not even to go into those waters.
For me, I can't say the word bicarb next to a DKA patient or else their head's going to explode. explode. That's what I've been taught, is that if they come in contact with baking soda, they're going to die and decay. So trying to optimize their pH right before you intubate them is kind of dicey. And I know that there have been some patients that we've considered, well, if they're about to arrest, I guess optimizing them briefly with sodium bicarb might actually be useful. Do you know anything further about with this patient or maybe a salicylate patient, if their acid base is so off, would it be beneficial to give a dose of bicarb before we have to intubate this patient?
Right. So I'm not really sure what the correct thing to do in that situation is. I, in general, don't use bicarb in these patients. I guess the one time I would consider using it, if their pH is so low and they're having dysrhythmias from the acidosis, I would consider bicarb. And if I'm not administering it, I'm going to intubate one of these patients, I certainly would have it immediately available at the bedside when I start the intubation, just in case they have any problems during the procedure.
Have you seen bad salicylate or bad DKA that have actually had dysrhythmias?
No, I haven't.
Okay. Because I'm always looking for that indication of when it's okay to give. But I know for DKA and for salicylates, dysrhythmias is one of the, it's the second most common reason that'll kill those patients. So if that's kind of a precursor of things to come, then that would be helpful. But it's just something I haven't seen a whole lot of. So.
Right. It's so rare. And like I said, in general, I try to avoid intubating these patients. I can't remember the last time I intubated a patient with DKA, actually.
And the one that I had a little two-year-old with new-onset DKA, pH of 6.8, had shock, looked absolutely terrible. And the kid was discharged 2 days later on his insulin. So we watched the kid for what seemed like days, but it was probably only about 30 minutes. And he looked awful, but he was taking enormous breaths and doing a way better job compensating than me. The thing that was most difficult for me is getting everyone else out of the room who were saying, you're going to intubate that patient, right? You're going to intubate that patient, right? Because I knew it was going to be a nightmare once I had that kid on the vent.
Right. Kids are usually pretty good at taking care of themselves, so sometimes it's best just to let them do their own thing and not intervene. Sometimes when you intervene, you actually make things worse for them.
I think one of the things that we didn't have at the time that I would absolutely use now would be an end-tidal CO2. I know these patients are going to be breathing like crazy, but once you see the trend of the end-tidal CO2 start to drop off, you know that they're starting to go into failure. That's a time where they're probably not keeping up anymore. But I really haven't seen even really severe DKA have trouble not compensating and looking like they were and actually tiring out, but they all look like they're going to.
Right. I agree with that.
So kind of these three things, we've covered a lot in just 30 minutes right now. And the last one that Jared puts in is right ventricular failure, which I am not going to touch with a 10-foot pole because we talked about it last month. And if you'd like to talk to Jared about it, I'll rent you guys a room. But right ventricular failure is basically look at the heart and then optimize everything that we just talked about. If you've got a problem with the right side of your heart, which is going to be trying to pushing blood into your lungs to oxygenate them, you need to optimize your oxygenation, your blood pressure, and your acid-base status. And if you can identify that ahead of time, that might also be a patient you want to avoid intubating if at all possible.
So the only pearl there, I'm not going to delve in those waters as well because the right ventricle is not my thing. But I can tell you this, if you have someone with a massive PE and they've got right ventricular failure, their right ventricle is trying to pump against an incredible amount of resistance. And the only thing you can really do to help offload the RV is to try to dilate the pulmonary vasculature. And I think the best thing to do that in the emergency department is to get some inhaled nitric oxide.
So having been specialized in airway for this long, have you always had these things in mind but maybe never said them so explicitly? Or is this kind of a trend in how we're approaching airway that's been coming up over the last few years?
The way I perform airway management now compared to when I was a resident 20 years ago is very different. So all these things we've been learning over time and just determining that there's other factors that are more important than what historically we felt was important, and this has evolved slowly over time. So what I do now is very different than what I did even just a few years ago.
So keeping these things in mind, we're really hoping that our residents will anyone listening to this will kind of take more of the delayed approach. I think delayed sequence intubation in a patient that's ill is kind of taking precedence over this. We're trying to get them oxygenated more. We're trying to maximize their blood pressure. We're trying to correct or address any metabolic acidosis before we have to intubate. And the RV is just a black box of badness as far as I'm concerned. Because these patients, if they have any of these outcomes, if they have an apneic event and their oxygen drops considerably, they have morbidity and mortality from this. If they have hypotension during intubation, they have a higher morbidity and mortality. They stay in the ICU longer, they have a higher, longer length of stay, and they have more bad outcomes from this. And the same with the acidosis. So it's kind of amazing to me how some of the things that we think we have completely nailed down in emergency medicine start to change over time. We are the airway gurus for the emergent airway, and thinking about not letting go of that position, but not using it as often is kind of a different change of pace for me. Is that fair to say?
That's excellent. Thanks.
I'm glad I could summarize. Thanks, John. Appreciate it.
All right.
Hi, everyone. This is Casey Solem, coming from Scottsdale, Arizona. Again, this month with some more peer review, although this month it's not necessarily much peer review. Rather, it's giving a community perspective on the things that Sackles talked about. I'm definitely not in the business of debating with Sackles, and considering just about everything I know about the airway came from him, even if there were something wrong, I wouldn't know it anyway. So I've introduced myself a couple of times now because I've done a couple of peer reviews, but I've practiced now in a total of 7 hospitals in the Phoenix area since I graduated from the UMC residency in 2014. So I got a bit of a broad variety of hospitals that I've worked in, ranging from single coverage, sometimes only physician in the building, up to a couple different level one trauma centers. So hopefully I can give some perspective on most of the different practice environments out there that are in the community. So I was really excited when I saw the topic for this month, because this is something that I get pretty geeked up about. I know we did this a lot in residency, but I've had a couple situations out since I've been practicing where I've been in a critical situation, and I've had some eyebrows raised from staff and even from other physicians when they see the way I try to resuscitate before I intubate, at least to a point where I feel like it's a safe procedure to perform. But I got to say, I almost never emergently intubate anybody anymore. I mean, there's obviously traumas and times where, you know, you need to protect an airway. If somebody's, you know, gurgling or aspirating actively in front of me, sure, I got to take the airway first. But I 100% agree with Sackles when he says that the patient needs resuscitation, not plastic in their trachea. So I always try to kind of communicate that to the people around me. And, you know, sometimes things are hectic and chaotic, and it's hard to explain exactly why I'm doing what I'm doing. But I, you know, the way that I generally approach a resuscitation is always to try to be the calmest person in the room, try to be the person who speaks softly, who is speaking slowly, who is always kind of updating people on what's happening, what I'm thinking, and what the next steps are in my head. That way, people, when they see that I slow play the intubation because I'm actively resuscitating first, they kind of have an idea of what I'm doing and why I'm doing it. I started realizing the importance of this when I got to one of my hospitals where we had to intubate patients in the ICU at night. There were no intensivists at night. And, you know, I found those were almost every time, they were the most difficult airways that I'd have, because these were people who were already on BiPAP, they were already on pressors, they were already maximized in every way possible. And by the time I got in the room, I found that there was nothing left that I could do to make my job any easier. Now, the only way to get them through the intubation safely is to be really proficient at the anatomical pieces of it. But generally down in the ED, we have a lot of room to improve. Patients are generally coming from the street, they're coming from home, they're coming from paramedics who've, you know, initiated a lot of resuscitation, but there's still a lot of room left to improve. So we can oftentimes make our job easier by taking a few extra minutes. I often leave about 5 to 10 minutes really from when the patient hits the door until I'm actually actually intubating. Sometimes longer, sometimes shorter, but in general, I'd say that's about the speed with which I get people intubated. And the three things that I always spend the most time thinking about are oxygenation, ventilation, and hypotension, and ventilation specifically meaning acidosis. I can't say that I've given a lot of thought to the right ventricular failure, mostly because I don't feel totally comfortable with, you know, I guess all the issues related to it, and probably more so because I just don't know all the physiology, what's happening with patients right when they hit the door. That's something that I'm often finding on further history from family or from somebody else, that they've got a history of right heart failure or pulmonary hypertension or something like that, or that they have a massive PE that I wasn't aware of when they first got into the door. So I always spend the most time thinking about oxygenation up front. I totally agree with both of these guys when they talk about using BiPAP. I use BiPAP pretty freely. The risk that I always try to make sure people know that I'm not running into is the risk of thinking that things have gotten so much better with the BiPAP that I'm not going to intubate. I know that there's lots of good literature out there that shows that putting people on BiPAP when they really needed to be intubated does not help outcomes. In fact, in the long term, it probably hurts their outcome because of the delay in getting the resuscitation that they actively needed. So I make it very clear to people that I'm using BiPAP as a form of pre-oxygenation rather than people getting the idea that I'm using BiPAP because I think I might be able to stave off an intubation. Now, of course, there are patients who are going to do just fine on BiPAP that you don't ever need to intubate, but I'm not talking about those patients. I'm talking about the ones where you look at them clinically and you say, I know that BiPAP isn't what they need. They need to be intubated. You just remember that sometimes BiPAP can be the best form of pre-oxygenation. Now, in the community, I find that's a little bit harder to do, partially because respiratory therapists, at least in the places that I've worked, aren't necessarily used to that, and partially because it's hard because oftentimes instead of getting a full team of people who show up to a resuscitation, like if I were in trauma 4 at UMC, I get, you know, one or two respiratory therapists and a couple of nurses and techs and maybe some medics who are still, you know, still around from bringing the patient in. So I think the resources tend to be a little bit more limited in that there's not, you know, a bunch of RTs around. One who can go grab a BiPAP machine, one who can go grab the ventilator circuits, one who can be starting to do bagging and putting on all the non-rebreathers and doing all those other things that a respiratory therapist needs to do. So I often find that I'm skipping that step. I know that we in residency would sometimes use the ventilator as a BiPAP machine, but I got to say I've had a lot of raised eyebrows from respiratory therapists when I try to do that in the community. With that said, though, there have been plenty of times where I have used BiPAP for pre-oxygenation, and I got to say, when you can get it done, I think those are some of the smoothest intubations that I've ever had. They're ones where 5 or 10 minutes on a BiPAP gets their sats up. They've recruited some of that, the alveoli. They've ventilated off some of that CO2 that's causing that metabolic acidosis. And then probably more importantly, it just gives everybody in the room a minute to take a big breath and just relax and say, we've got those numbers starting to look better. I think that if you can take the emergency away from the people around you and yourself when you see terrible numbers coming off the monitor, that can really pay dividends in the success that you have with your actual overall resuscitation. But I just want to emphasize again, the decision to intubate has to be decisive, and it's got to be yours to make. You make it quickly, and then you stick with it. Now, of course, if the situation changes, you may change your mind on whether the BiPAP may be the definitive treatment that they need, but don't come into it wishy-washy and have people around you then wondering, are we using BiPAP long-term, or is this just something that we're doing to pre-oxygenate? Just try to be really decisive and clear about what you're doing. I found that that's been the most helpful for me. We talked about the non-rebreather. I definitely agree with turning that valve all the way up until, you know, it seems like the little knob's going to fly off. 15 liters doesn't really seem to do much, but if you can crank that thing up, I found that I get a lot more success with people getting pre-oxygenated better. And that's something we didn't talk as much about with oxygenation in the podcast, but that I spent a lot of time thinking about is if you're going to bag somebody, which I do most times that I intubate somebody, I bag them at least at some point, make sure you're putting a PEEP valve on there. I know that's something that at UMC and I think South Campus is pretty commonplace too, but it's not necessarily as commonplace out in the community, I found anyway, in at least my 7 hospitals I've been at, that people don't naturally just think to grab that the PEEP valve to keep some positive pressure on the airways. But if the whole point of either using BiPAP or in this case using a back valve mask is that you want to recruit some lung and get better oxygenation and ventilation, or at least oxygenation in this case, then make sure that you're using a PEEP valve, crank it up to 5 or 10 or whatever you think the appropriate number is. But back valve mask without the PEEP valve puts you at a pretty significant disadvantage. Apneic oxygenation is kind of interesting because it's something that I love the idea of, and I wish I were better at doing it, but I'll be honest, in community, at least in my practice, I'm maybe about 50% of actually getting it on board. Oftentimes there's, again, fewer people around, and I'm still focusing on the resuscitation, and you know, all the nurses and techs and RTs, they all have a job to do, and they're all thinking about grabbing the bag, grabbing the ventilator, grabbing the IV lines that the nurses need to get, and the drugs and everything that we're doing to resuscitate, that it sometimes falls through the cracks for me. I think it's great, but I just can't say that I'm quite as perfect with doing it. But that's certainly not to say that it shouldn't be done. It's just that that it sometimes can be a little bit more of a resource challenge to remember. They talked a little bit about delayed sequence intubation. I'm going to be honest, it's something that I've never actually done, but I love the idea of, again, if you know if somebody's too agitated or too combative or too upset for whatever reason, they're not tolerating the you know the things you need to do to resuscitate them before you end up putting a tube in their throat, then I think the idea of kind of using procedural sedation for the procedure being intubation is a cool concept, and it's certainly something that I think about, but I just haven't had that opportunity really come up where I felt like I've needed to use it. So moving on from hypoxia to hypotension, this is something that I find people around me are a little bit less aware of. I find that when I'm actively resuscitating a patient and holding off on intubation until I feel like they're stable enough to tolerate the intubation, something that a lot of people that I work with don't seem to be thinking or on the same page with me until I communicate it, is that a hypotensive patient is not somebody that you want to be paralyzing, sedating, and then putting on positive pressure for all the reasons that they talked about. The first is that the sedation can take away that adrenergic drive that was keeping their, you know, the blood pressure at whatever, you know, low number they had to start with. And then secondly, switching somebody from a negative pressure respiration to positive pressure ventilation using a bag or an endotracheal tube is something that, for all the reasons that Jared likes to point out, it reduces preload, reduces afterload, and can take that patient who was teetering on the edge and really push him over the edge. So I spent a lot of time, I agree with Sackles, pressors and fluids are always kind of the mainstay, and Sackles talks about fluids being the first step. I agree with that. I always start with fluids. Almost nobody will I give no fluids to if they're hypotensive and I'm trying to get them stable enough to intubate. They asked the question about using peripheral infusions for pressors, and I got to say that something that, you know, at least in my practice in the community, again, there's lots of docs who will be listening to this who will probably have a different opinion, but I have absolutely zero problem running a levofed drip or even pushing push dose pressors through peripheral lines. In fact, I could almost say it's not my practice to put in a central line before I start pressors on somebody. In general, if they need pressors, they need pressors, and I start them when they need them. And then I can work on either putting in a central line myself or getting them to the ICU where it can be done in a more controlled environment. But I have absolutely make that very, very clear that at least in my practice, 99% of the time that I'm starting pressors on somebody, I'm starting them through a peripheral line and then converting later. And that later may not be minutes, it may be hours later. And of course, there's the downsides and there's the risks of running pressors through peripheral lines if it extravasates. But the reality is that I don't necessarily have all the resources and the time to be sitting and putting in a central line every time somebody makes a change in their hemodynamics and requires some pressors. We talked a little bit about which pressors do you use. I've kind of said this has been my thing on previous peer reviews, but I always just use what you're good at. Use what you know. Use what you're comfortable with. Don't fart around trying to try something new that you've never used before because you think somebody told you on some podcast somewhere that it may be a better option. In general, the pressors, you know, they all get the job done. Now, I do agree that if you're talking about push-dose pressors, there was kind of that trend of people starting off with push-dose fentanyl and then switching over to push-dose epi. I almost exclusively use push-dose epi now for the reasons that, that Sackles pointed out, that it causes both a positive inotropy as well as a peripheral vascular constriction. So you don't just clamp down the blood vessels without helping the heart to pump against that increased resistance. You're getting a little bit of both. So that way, the actual cardiac output can go up while your pressure is going up, which is really what the whole point of putting pressors on is, to get cardiac output to improve. And then we talked a little bit about which induction agents to use. I got to say, I'd never heard of the ketamine causing shock and hemodynamic collapse. I totally believe it because Sackle says it, but it's not something I'd ever heard of before. So it's something I'll have to look into a little bit more, but I never really use it in general. If I'm going to intubate somebody, I almost exclusively use etomidate. It's just my go-to. Once again, it's what I'm comfortable with. It's what I've used since my intern year, and I really don't anticipate that changing unless something new comes out or some new information or data comes out that shows that it's, you know, it's the wrong choice or that something else is better. Then moving on to acidosis, this one's a little bit tougher because you can't see somebody's pH just looking at them. You know, it's clear if someone's obviously in DKA, 100% agree, do not intubate that patient if you can avoid it at all. Even if they're not keeping up, you know, if you can do the Winters formula and see that they're not blowing off the CO2 that they need to in order to keep their pH at a decent level, the thing is, like they mentioned, if somebody's got 30 to 40 liters per minute of minute ventilation, there's no way that any ventilator is going to be able to keep up with that. So I'll keep those people awake, even with questionably protected airways, if I can, until I get their underlying metabolic derangement under control, at least enough that I can turn those numbers around to a point where then I can intubate them. And then they talked about bicarb. Almost never will I push bicarb in somebody who I think needs to be intubated. Presumably, they need to be intubated because there's a problem with their respiration. If they're not breathing, or, you know, which includes ventilation, if they're not breathing rapidly enough or deeply enough to blow off all the CO2 that's in their body, then giving them a push of bicarb, which just converts their metabolic acidosis into a respiratory acidosis, isn't really going to help the situation. Now they've got more CO2 that's sitting in their body that they're not blowing off, which is causing a respiratory acidosis. So hey, you're robbing Peter to pay Paul, or whatever the metaphor is supposed to be. So that's something that I'm very, very clear about not giving but giving pushes of bicarb to somebody who has any respiratory compromise, and I don't think they're going to be able to blow off the CO2 that they're converting. With that said, though, I think that the things that in general that we're doing to help pre-oxygenate somebody are going to be the things that help to ventilate them too. So bag valve mask, if they're hypoventilating, or putting on BiPAP, those are all things that can be starting to turn around their pH at the same time that they're turning around their O2 sat. And then, you know, I totally agree with using end-tidal CO2. That's something that is super commonplace now out in the community. Everybody's using it. I've never been any place where anybody's had any difficulty or any trouble getting the end-tidal CO2 monitoring, which obviously is very helpful for figuring out how I can predict what somebody's pH is going to be without getting gases in real time. And the last thing I was going to say, just, you know, because we talk about the difference between the community and you know, UMC, it's, you know, I talk about resources maybe being a little bit more scarce. Although the truth is that what I found from my time out here is that nurses, techs, respiratory therapists, hospital systems, emergency departments, when out in the community, this is their day job. This is what they do. They're really, really good at resuscitating patients. So although it may not be, you know, reading the most up-to-date article that just came out of, you know, one of the professors from our department, or, you know, or having just had a conversation with Sackles or Mosier, you know, somebody who, you know, who's big into the, you know, these type of concepts, these people are very, very intuitive, very good at resuscitating people. They're very good at getting things done that I need done. And in general, they all want to learn. So taking a few moments during that resuscitation before you intubate, when people are asking, well, why aren't we intubating right now? Don't you think they need to be intubated right away? Taking those few minutes and in a calm, slow voice, talking them through exactly why you're doing what you're doing, I think pays dividends. You know, building a relationship with them, but then also helps them to understand, you know, how much they can trust you and your decisions that you're making, and know that you're not slow playing the situation because you're young or you're scared or you're out of control, but because you're actually in control and you're making really calm, clear decisions. Well, I think that about does it. As usual, I found a way to talk for way too long. But thank you guys for the opportunity. Thanks for taking some time to listen. And look forward to hopefully doing this again in the future. And once again, everybody who was there in my days, I still miss you. All right, take care.